Fourth case this morning, Couch v. United States.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant in this case, Alice Couch, the administrator of the estate of Billy Couch. Unlike the cases that preceded this one, this case comes down to, I think, a very simple, small issue and down to a very few words in an Illinois workers' compensation statute. And I hope for that reason I'll be very brief because I don't know that there's all that much I can add to put a gloss on that statute. The post office here, the federal government, said that it is a borrowing employer, and because it's a borrowing employer, it's not subjective to tort liability, and it bases it all upon the borrowing loaning employer statute that Illinois has. And my point is quite simple, that the statute says that someone is a loaning employer, and that's the key here, because if B&B Trucking is the loaning employer, that makes the post office the borrowing employer and protects the post office. The statute said that it applies where a business consists of furnishing employees. The statute does not say it applies to businesses which include furnishing employees. And I think there is a distinct difference between the two. At least that is our premise.
Mr. Ratzak?
Yes, sir.
I want to ask you a few questions about the legal question here. Before we do, could you explain to me, if I understand this correctly, the accident was that a forklift ran over Mr. Couch's foot.
Correct.
And a couple of years later, he died as a result of
yes,
that?
Yes, there was a series of infections that eventually led to his death. Because of the timing of the case, none of that's actually in the record. It's all contained in the complaint.
I know it's not relevant, strictly speaking. But it was, in essence, a medical problem that kind of ran out of control?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me ask you. We know that B&B was furnishing something to the Postal Service.
Yes, sir.
How do we distinguish between furnishing employees and furnishing services, mail transportation services?
I think, and I hope the difference is, that if you're furnishing employees, that is all that you do. That is typically what an employment agency does. Somebody, I call up, and they send me five people to work on my assembly line, and they charge me $14 an hour. The difference is here is that the B&B Trucking did everything. And by everything, I mean the record shows that they furnished not only truck drivers, they furnished the trucks, they furnished the dispatcher, they furnished mechanics to service the trucks, they furnished administrative staff to coordinate this, and I think it says they even furnished the custodial services.
Well, for example, someone who drives interstates frequently, you'll see I don't think it says lease necessarily, but it's private vehicles carrying U.S. mail.
Correct, sir. Yes, sir.
That's
exactly what's going on here. From what I can tell from checking around the country, that's simply how the post office takes care of or handles over-the-road mail. The trucks you see in the city are the blue and white ones with the nice post office emblem. On the road, you don't see that. They've apparently contracted everything out. And when I say everything, I mean everything. And that's the distinction here.
There, under the Federal Tort Claims Act, there's also a line of cases that I hope the government will also address, in which the Postal Service has consistently taken the position that the employees of these contractors under these transportation contracts are not Postal Service employees, so that the Postal Service is not liable for accidents that they cause. Could you address that line of cases?
And that was our point here, was that it appears to be unusual to us, and that in this case the post office or the government is taking up for the post office a liability that it otherwise would not want to have. In other words, if any of these over-the-road drivers, if a B&B driver like Billy Couch runs into somebody on the highway, by virtue of the law that the government wants here, the post office is going to be a borrowing employer, and it's going to be liable, as Your Honor has observed. It has not that, as Your Honor has observed, the post office has argued against in other cases. I think, I was just going to add, I think that maybe the reason that you only find it in Illinois is because I'm not able to find other states that have this similar borrowing, loaning, employer statute.
Well, and everybody's got it in terms of at least common law. And I know Indiana has it in terms of...
In terms of common law.
Workers' comp.
But my, at least from what I've seen, the ones I've looked for, they look at control. And when once we get to the control issue, the post office never has control. The Illinois statute is so specific.
Do you think there's really any material difference between the old common law and vibrant common law test of control and the statutory test of furnishing, since we have to distinguish between furnishing services and furnishing employees?
I think there's a significant distinction, and I think it's illustrated in this case. Without the statute, the post office, as I understand it, is agreeing. They don't exercise control.
Well, I understand they're relying upon it, and the district judge did here. But how different, since we have to distinguish between furnishing services, under which there's no employment relationship there,
exactly,
and furnishing employees, how do we tell the difference other than by control?
I'm trying to think how to... I'm not sure that this is going to answer Your Honor's question, which is why I'm hesitating. Once we take control out of the case, you create a situation like this where ostensibly the borrowing employer becomes an employer...
Without control.
Without any control whatsoever, without any need to look at control. It creates a sui generis situation where that borrowing employer automatically becomes an employer for all purposes under the common law and under the workers' compensation law. If control is going to be an element, and this may come from the fact that we talked about control in our brief, but the point was that in the situation where a business is not just furnishing employees but doing a whole service, typically the business employing the truck driver does all of the control. In a situation where it's more of the employment agency situation, which is what I think the statute was meant to cover, the borrowing employer, in fact, usually exercises a great deal of control, which has led to the workers' comp and litigation.
Mr. Ratzak, did you all file a cross motion for summary judgment on this question?
No, we did not. No, we did not. In retrospect, I might have made things easier for my side, but we did not. That's why in our brief we simply asked that it be reversed. I suspect that this court's order, if you find, as we are asking it to do, would lead to a summary judgment motion on behalf of the plaintiff on this issue down below. The other point that I two points I wanted to make. One is simply that the statute talks about that your business consists of furnishing employees and not including furnishing employees, and that's a distinction. The other thing I would like the court to consider is the purpose of the statute. Let's see what the legislature was addressing. When the legislature passed that statute, you can tell from the other portions of the statute, the legislature was concerned with instances where an employee was injured and the two likely employers both disagree as to what was going on. And the statute set up a hierarchy to make sure that the employee got benefits quickly. They did that because they were addressing situations like the employment agency situation where I am the employer, but the person where I send the person exercises a great deal of control and it's not clear who the employer was. That's not the situation that you have when you have something like B&B Trucking, which does the whole service for you. There is no way that under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act that B&B Trucking in a case like this could ever, in fact, claim it was not an employer. And that would suggest to me that is why the legislature did not intend the statute to affect that type of scenario. Unless the court has further questions at this point, I'll save my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court? Counsel? Just to answer one of the court's initial questions about what happened. As I understand it, based on the conversations I've had with the trial counsel at the settlement conference ordered by this court, Billy Couch actually overdosed on pain medications. Essentially, his foot was run over. He developed, allegedly, a pain syndrome and was taking a lot of pain medications. Obviously, plaintiff would allege that it was an accidental overdose, but there's not any evidence on the record at this point as to what happened beyond that. Additionally, counsel talked about the Postal Service and contracting out.
I guess the main thing was ultimately the injury occurred that caused the pain, either mentally or actually, was a result of that.
Certainly the plaintiff's allegation is that it was a proximate result of the injury in 2008. I think what the court's been looking at is sort of the services versus contract issue. And if we would submit that in order to find for the plaintiff and reverse the district court's judgment here, the court has to overrule its earlier decision in Luna specifically, but also in Bellamini. And Luna is a 2006 case where, if you look at the description, at least in the district court's decisions about that contract, it's virtually identical to the one in this issue. RCI, the contractor in Luna.
Our court's opinion really didn't examine very carefully the difference between furnishing employees and furnishing services. So help me. How do we distinguish between those? How does your case here differ, for example, from management consultants brought into a company, a law firm representing a company, cleaning company, security contractors, and so on?
I think you have to look at the contracts that govern those relationships, and the contract in this case is very clearly involves the provision of employees. It directs what the employees get paid. It directs where they go,
it's
when they go there.
It's called a contract for mail service.
Right? Correct. But if you look at the provisions, I think it's quite clear. We control where they go, when they go there, how often they go to the different, I think they're distribution centers or postal offices, down to like 5 or 10 minute increments. What they do when they get there, they're required to talk to the Postal Service employees to ensure that all the mail's been tendered over to them before they
leave. They're required to wear a badge, right?
Yes.
What does the badge say?
The badge identifies them as a non-postal contract employee or non-postal contractor. Okay. But in order to get that badge, we screen every driver that is presented to us. They have to present fingerprints. We do a background investigation.
So why does the Postal Service treat these people as not Postal Service employees when they cause accidents? And how can the law handle that?
I don't think that it's inconsistent under the law that you can have both. We don't have control. We're not arguing that we control the employees. We're relying on the statutory test, and the statutory test doesn't require a finding that we control the employees.
Then how doesn't control figure in trying to distinguish between furnishing employees and furnishing services? You just said a minute ago, we all the things that you control.
That's in the contract in terms of a much more general sense, not necessarily that we control them on a day-to-day basis.
Let me put this to you as bluntly as I can. I do not see how the Postal Service can maintain, as it has in cases over several decades, that drivers under these contracts are not Postal Service employees but are independent contractors for purposes of liability to third parties, but that they are Postal Service employees when it comes to workers' compensation claims.
I think there's sort of two answers there. One is you look at the contract and you look at the statutory test, which looks at the overall business of the loaning employer. Also, I don't think that it's the Postal Service's position that these are our employees in a traditional sense. They're borrowed employees, as that term is statutorily defined under Illinois law, and this court's
defined. It's just, it says furnishing employees.
It's whether a whether the business's enterprise or a substantial part thereof is furnishing employees. I think the contract in this case makes it clear that it is for employees, and I think the contract in RCI that was discussed in the district court's decision, the exact there's two points that are very, very similar. One is there's a provision in the contract in Luna that specifically disclaims liability for the acts or omissions of the contractor employees, just like the Postal Service would do if this or in that particular situation. And that the contract in Luna very specifically says the Navy, in that case, had no control, did not directly supervise the employees. They told them in a general sense what to do, what jobs needed to be done, what services needed to be provided, how those people provided those services, how they performed those jobs, how many people did it, who did it. All of that was left to the contractor. And Luna, I'm sorry.
Well, if you could include your answer for Judge Hamilton.
In Luna, I'm sort of lost my train of thought. So if you can.
Well, let me ask you this in more general terms. Do you have other contract situations? Do you is your security for the Postal Service in some regard provided by contract employees?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, I assume that much like this building, the Postal Service would contract out maybe custodial services or, you know, other sort of general services. But in that case, the contract would be more like a traditional, what I would call a straight services contract. We have this job that will pay you a flat rate for that. That rate can be certainly based on the cost of labor and other things, but it's when it gets done is the only sort of certain aspect of a contract. Whereas here, if workers' compensation insurance premiums go up, or if the wage rate as set by the Department of Labor goes up, the contract is adjusted to reflect that. It's not just that the Postal Service takes a paternal approach, as the appellant argued in its brief, regarding, you know, how they accept bids. These are the line items that are adjusted regularly based, like, over the time of the contract or over the term of the contract when situations change. If the Postal Service were to eliminate routes or trips, we wouldn't continue paying a flat rate. That contract would be adjusted, and vice versa. If we added trips, they would.
Are these contracts primarily between the few central locations, say in a state, and all the many post offices that are around a state?
The contract in this case is exactly that, and there are several of these highway contract routes that go in between distribution centers, and in certain parts of the country, the Postal Service has deemed that cost effective. To hire, you know, non-postal drivers to drive these routes. There are certainly other delivery-type contracts that the Postal Service enters into, but in a lot of those cases, for example, UPS or Federal Express, we contract with them to help with some of our delivery, but a substantial portion of Federal Express's business isn't furnishing employees or drivers to drive for the Postal Service.
But here, obviously, it's not just drivers that are provided, but trucks. And, I mean, would mechanics who work for B&B Trucking be Postal Service employees under your theory? Would they be borrowed employees?
No, because I don't think they'd be doing the work of the Postal Service, which is delivering mail.
Let me try to go back, Ms. Byrd, and ask you to describe what could justify treating somebody in Mr. Couch's position as a borrowed employee for purposes of workers' comp, but not as an employee for purposes of FTCA liability to third parties?
I think the distinction is within the purpose, the broader purpose of workers' compensation and the bargain between employees and employers. Generally, employees give up a right to tort damages from their employer for on-the-job injuries, and in exchange, they get no-fault liability. They get a guaranteed payment for their injuries. Employers and borrowing employers, if either the statutory test or the control test is met, also they give up a right to defend. It's no-fault liability. They give up a right to defend their, the claim that it wasn't their fault, but in exchange they must pay employees.
This sounds a lot like heads we win, tails you lose when it comes to tort liability.
It certainly does, and I think that that was addressed and recognized certainly in the Bellamini decision as well. But we paid workers' comp. That's the thing that you have to remember, is that the contract specifically includes that line item for workers' compensation insurance. We pay that to B&B. B&B then provides it. So the purpose of this borrowing employer statute is that we also should get the benefit of that bargain that all other employers in Illinois would get, even though we are not the direct, actual employer in the case.
I have one little question here. This injury occurred as a result of a postal worker, if whatever, causing the injury, as I understand it.
That's the plaintiff's allegation. We answered the complaint and no factual discovery on liability was done.
We're assuming that, though.
That seems to be the case.
Now, as we know, in manufacturing stuff, where there is workers' compensation, they also, if a defective machine can have a separate products liability suit outside of that. And I assume if a third party negligently runs into a truck, that negligent party is subject to suit beyond workers' comp.
Yes, that's correct.
So that's just that's the way it is. And I guess what we're looking at here is, and you're telling us we got to scrutinize the contract, I guess.
I think the contract here makes it clear that the Postal Service contracted for the employees. They're doing the work of the Postal Service. These are routes that were previously driven by postal employees, and it's just that the Postal Service has deemed it cost-effective to hire a contractor to provide drivers for these routes.
Do you have other contracts that work the way that the plaintiff wants them to work in this case?
Not on this delivery issue, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, we've only really been looking at the delivery contracts of the Postal Service. The much broader what else the Postal Service contracts for, I'm not totally sure of that. My time is up, so unless the Court has further questions, we ask that it affirm the District Court's judgment. Thank you.
It's been a long morning for honors. I'll be very brief. I want to make simply one point, and that's to take a look at the Luna case. Government filed the supplemental authority, which is another one of the trial court opinions in Luna, and that opinion set out the contract. In that contract, the Navy furnished to the people being sent in by the loaning employer, the Navy furnished office space, parking, telephones, utilities, office supplies, computer equipment, computer software, vehicles, other equipment, custodial services, and emergency medical services. This court does not have to overrule Luna to find out that the facts here were all of those things are being provided by B&P Trucking and not the post office. We have a different scenario, and I think that's the difference between Luna, where the agency was providing people simply to do various specific jobs for the Navy, and this where B&B Trucking was stepping in to perform the entire task, really basically as a subsidiary of the post office. Unless the Court has further questions, my time is concluded. We simply ask for a reversal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.